The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
There you are. Good afternoon on this Monday afternoon. If you want to contact the programme, as always, text to 51551 or you can send an email to ray@rte.ie. On Saturday night, we had a sort of bizarre programme which culminated in Ciara, the psychic sheep, predicting that Ireland would beat Scotland in the rugby. She got it right, did Ciara the sheep, owned by Tom Dunn, not that Tom Dunn. This Tom Dunn is a farmer from County Wicklow, and his son Sean was there as well. And Sean was telling me that he met Prince Charles, and he was asked if Prince Charles was the most famous person he's ever met, and he said, no, the most famous person I've ever met is Ivan Scott. Ivan who? Says I. Well, Ivan Scott is a famous sheep shearer. You see, Sean is 13 and a sheep shearing commentator. That's why he was on the show on Saturday night. So Ivan Scott, Tom sent me on an email, Sean's dad, to let me know of all the records that Ivan Scott from Donegal holds in sheep shearing. The Guinness World Record, shearing a sheep in 37 seconds. He did it on live TV. A 9-hour world record set in Cromwell, England. Cornwall in England. He managed to shear 867 lambs. And he has numerous. So that's Ivan Scott. Very famous sheep shearer, and he's from Donegal. If you listen, Ivan, good afternoon to you. Great picture, mentioning the rugby, great picture on the cover of the Examiner today of Tadhg Furlong. We spoke to Tadhg when we were down in New Ross, and he scored one of Ireland's four tries on Saturday morning here, Saturday evening in Japan. And it's a great picture because he's there touching the ball down over the line, and the look on his face, his tongue sticking out, and he's really relishing. Really relishing that try he scored. I spotted a sign in the crowd there when I was watching it yesterday morning. It was yesterday morning, wasn't it? Yeah, you get confused. And it said, New Ross under 12 rugby team supporting Tadhg Furlong. So I don't know how they got out there, but they were there. Underneath that picture is that article, which I found fascinating today. 300 strong lay assembly from 22 parishes vote to let priests marry. And this is a story about the Killala Diocese, made up of 22 mainly rural parishes in North Mayo and West Sligo. And what they've done is they've surveyed the parishioners to see what their attitudes are to contentious issues within the Catholic Church. Initially, 1,500 people across the diocese were surveyed anonymously on a range of broad questions. And then a 300-strong diocesan assembly, which included delegates from the 22 parishes, then voted on a range of issues. So here's what they found. And these are parishioners in Killala who are attending Mass on a regular basis. 85% backed the view that priests should be allowed to marry. 81% supported priests who have married being returned to active ministry. 80% backed women being ordained. 69% agreed that women be ordained to the priesthood. So yeah, 80% that they become deacons, and 69%, that's 70%, agreed that women should be ordained. And 86% agreed that the church should change its attitude to homosexuality. So it's at odds, and there's a lot of mismatch in there between the thoughts and opinions of the parishioners in Killala and the thoughts and the wishes of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. It's a little sort of microcosm there, a little window into the world of the problems within the Catholic Church. And I see that the bishop has said that anything that he couldn't sort out locally, he would pass on. So he'd be passing on their opinions and wishes to the Irish Episcopal Conference and to the Apostolic Nuncio. And then that'll get to the relevant authorities in Rome. And they'll read it and they'll put it up like that and throw it in the bin. That's what'll happen with that, I would imagine. I was in Super Value yesterday, and I hadn't got a bag with me because I was coming back from somewhere. You know, when you leave the house to go shopping, you always bring the bag with you. But if you're on the way back and you decide, oh yeah, I have to get those things. Yeah, I know I should have bags in the car, but I didn't have. So I got to the checkout and the lady said, which sort of bag do you want? So she presented me with the bag that we're used to now in a lot of supermarkets, which is the 79-cent one. I don't know where the 22-cent one has gone. And then she presented me with another one, which looked like a traditional plastic bag. It was white in colour and see-through nearly, well, at least translucent. And I said, oh, the old bags are back. The 22-cent one. She said, no, 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 no. She says, this is a compostable bag. A what? I said. Yes, she says, it's compostable. And I said, how muchable is it? And she said, it's 89 centable. 89 cents for a compostable bag. And I'm just reading about it here. So when you're finished using it, it doesn't seem as strong to me. Now, I only used it once. It doesn't seem as strong to me as the 79-cent bag, and you'd probably only get two uses out of it. And when you're finished with it, you can put it into your brown bin. And once it's taken to an industrial composting sites, it turns into water and carbon dioxide within 90 days. So that's good for the environment, isn't it? That's good for the environment. So it's 89 cent. And you won't get as much use of it as the 79 cent one. Where are the 22 cent bags gone? Because we're still hearing that we were trailblazers when it came to the environment. We were the first country to introduce the plastic bag levy back in 2002. 17 years ago, it's hard to believe. But a lot of the supermarkets don't allow you that option anymore. They're selling you the 79 cent one, and now SuperValue are selling you the 89 cent one. Who's making profit from that, I wonder? Who's making profit from that? The Dart in Dublin is in the news today. I'm sure you've heard about it. Irish Rail is trying to persuade Dart users to stagger morning journeys to reduce overcrowding. Now, look, lads, if we could stagger our journeys, we would. A lot of employers don't allow their staff to work flexi time, so that's why your trains and darts are packed at a certain hour of the morning, because that's the way the world works. That's the way the world works. People work 9 to 5, so they have to be in the dart at 7:30 or 7:45 or whatever, and so do all the other hundreds and thousands of people, and that's why it's packed. So anything you say isn't going to change that. Anyway, it got us talking about the darts and the Lewis and public transport in general. And then Neil had spotted a few signs up in the Lewis recently. One of them is, take off your bag during busy periods when on board with us. It's manners. And it is, like, it's, you know, I've been in a packed Lewis and it's, you know, it gets very tight. It gets very tight. And I have been knocked over by somebody's umbrella. Now, just not knocked over, but you get a, you know, a nudge of an umbrella, and then somebody turns to talk to a friend of a bag on their back, and you get a nudge in the face. So I can see why they're doing that. Take off your bag during busy periods when on board with us. It's manners. That's a bit sort of, I'm just putting the emphasis there. It's not in capitals or bold. It's manners. And then to say, move down the tram during busy times, dash. It is manners. I think they say it's manners. It is manners. And they announce it actually on the Lewis. They go, could you please move down the tram? Could you please move? I noticed the thing. You know, they have these areas, these big areas, and they're sort of designated priority seating for people with buggies or people with wheelchairs or whatever. The problem is that the sign is on the side of the priority seating. So if you come into the Lewis and you sit down in that area, your back is to the sign. So I was standing up, looking at a person sitting in the priority seating with the sign over their head, and a person beside them standing up with the buggy. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, they should be sitting down because it's priority seating for them, but they don't know because the sign is over their head. So I don't know how you work that. I don't know how they work that. But they should have been looking at that sign, pointing back at them. I don't know. It's difficult. A couple of silly things. Because it's Monday. You need a bit of silliness on a Monday, don't you? Because it's tough starting off a new week, and now it's raining outside and summer's gone and autumn's here and winter's around the corner. So you need some silliness. There's a funny Twitter account called Thoughts of a Dog. Did you ever wonder what's going on in the brain of your dog? Did you? No, you didn't. Do you have a dog even? Well, here's a few examples of some of the tweets on this Thoughts of a Dog thing. I found a pizza crust on our walk today, says the dog, in case anyone was thinking of giving up on their dreams. Another one, the small neighbour human came over after school to try and get me to eat their homework. While I do not condone such behaviour, I complied. I like that one. Another thought of a dog, petting me with your foot only counts as half a pet. I often do that with Stanley. I pet him with the foot, so it only counts as half a pet. Didn't know that. And final thought of a dog on this Monday afternoon. Sometimes I'll go outside only to realise that it is inside that I desired all along. See, dogs and humans aren't as different as you thought. The grass is greener on the other side. Yeah. Have you ever thought about what your dog's thinking? I wonder, is he thinking about the colours on the walls of your house? Now, Hans, I have to confess that when we got the house painted indoors about 10 years ago, we chose that infamous colour from Farrow and Ball, elephant's breath. That's it. We have elephant's breath up in our sitting room. There you go. Well, Farrow and Ball have a new list of colours. And I'm looking at them here, but what I've done is, right, this is just for a bit of crack on a Monday afternoon. I've made up some Farrow and Ball colours. They're not really, they're just out of my head. And then I've included some of the real ones. And your job is to spot the real colours and the makey-up colours. Okay, so you know elephant's breath. Dead salmon. Do you reckon that's a real one? Avocado stone. What about that? Mole's breath. Workhorse grey. Is that a real one? Dog breath. That's always... So some of those are real, some of them aren't. Dead salmon, avocado stone, mole's breath, workhorse grey, dog breath. Just see if you can figure that out. This is a good one. Men with a spring in their step or who take wider strides are less likely to suffer from erectile dysfunction. Now, erectile dysfunction is a serious condition for men of a certain age. But they've done research and they've published it in the Journal of Sexual Medicine. They studied the gait and erectile dysfunction of 324 men, and this is what they found. A consultant urologist from Bristol. Maybe a longer stride correlates with better blood vessel function, so you're striding away and it lets everything move around better, so there's more blood going in there. Or, he says, or it could be a she, more confidence about sexual prowess. You see, so you know what you have, and you know what you have to offer, so you're strutting around the place. Cock of the hoop, excuse the intended pun. So the bigger steps you take, the more confident you are. That's what they say. That's silliness on a Monday. 51551, Ray at RTE.ie. No bags, Ray. I have two under my eyes if you want them, spill. And weren't the two 22 cent bags the old plastic ones that are not recyclable? They're not recyclable, Fran. No, they're not. No, you're right. With regard to the signs on the Lewis ending with its manners, it's a sad day in Ireland where common sense and mannerly gestures have to be pointed out to us. Fair point, Mary. 51551, Ray at RTE.ie. Good afternoon. Louise in Galway, enjoy that. What a wonderful song on this wet, miserable Monday, says Louise in Galway. That's Mick Flannery and Fool. And I was making the dinner last night and I had one of those selection of songs that Spotify put together for you. When I say Spotify, it's some computer algorithm that follows all your listening habits and then comes up with a list of songs. And that was on it, which I probably had included in some playlist along the way, but it just took me by surprise. And you go, what? That's lovely. And there it is for you. Mick Flannery and Fool. Now, on trains, try getting a train from Skerries into Dublin in the morning rush hour. It's like sardines in a tin, and that's before the train picks up at the stations closer to town. If somebody fainted, says Claire, nobody would notice because there's no space to fall. I think everything is back to peak, isn't it? I noticed the traffic on the roads is brutal these mornings. So I wonder, is it as bad as it was during the boom times, or is it worse? On the bags, you can use those bags, the compostable ones, for your leftover food. They can go into the food bin, as far as I know. So handy way of using them. I'm just looking there, because you can get... So they're compostable bags, and they're not as strong as the other ones, but you can get a small... How many is it? 20, pack of 24. And we're just looking. I asked them to do a bit of research outside, because... You can get a pack of 24 bin liners, 10 litre, for €3.80. So that works out at a lot less than 89 cent each. So maybe that's what I should do. Go around to that place in the supermarket, pick up some small compostable caddy liners, 10 litres, and then use them instead of paying the 89 cent. With regards to the thoughts of dogs, what if the dog thinks I love to throw the ball? Fail him. Those 22 cent bags may not be recyclable. We have had ours for 17 years, is that person. And was in Toronto in August. All their trains, metro, streetcars, etc., have seating clearly signposted for use by people with buggies, disabilities, etc. But they're a different colour to the rest of the seating. So very clear. That makes sense, Aisling, as opposed to having a sign behind the people who are supposed to get the message. Where do we put that sign? Put it there. Did anybody think that the person who should be reading it can't see it because it's behind their head? Unless they've eyes in the back of their head. Unless you've eyes in the back of your head. 5155 on RaidRTE.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we were all saddened by the death earlier this summer of much-loved comedian and performer Brendan Grace. And until his untimely death, Brendan had been working to put on a variety show in the Olympia Theatre to support Engaging Dementia, who provide training and resources for those who care for people with dementia. The concert is on tomorrow night, and one of the groups involved is the Forget-Me-Nots Choir. Nora Owen, former politician, is a member of the choir, and she joins in. How are you doing, Nora?
I'm doing great, and I mean, it's when I hear Brendan's name, I just get a little bout of sadness coming over me, because he got involved with the Forget-Me-Nots Choir. He was in America, sent me an email, said, look, I'd like to do something for dementia. He said, I'd like to come along to your choir. So he came out several times over the last 2 years, sang with us, and then we heard about this concert, so we're singing in the concert tomorrow night. And along with, it's called Thanks for the Memory, so it has lots of people that people will love to hear again. Red Hurley and Dickie Dock, as we've had Dickie Rock and Paddy Cole and Stockton's Wing and Donal Lunny, and then there's some more
Lisa Lam is in there, beautiful voice,
and Foster and Allen and Mike Denver and Sharon Shannon.
So stellar lineup.
And we've been, some of these celebrities have been coming out to the choir, and we've been practicing with them, so it's amazing, because a lot of the people in the choir are over 70, I'm over 70, but a lot of them are over 80, and some of them even over 90.
Okay.
And they're all coming in tomorrow night to sing.
So Brendan contacted you.
Yes, I had interviewed Brendan when I did a little bit of work on TV3. Mm. I was doing the midweek program, and I interviewed him. And then out of the blue, I got an email saying, I'd like to do something for dementia, Alzheimer's. He said, I believe you've been talking about it, and you're in the choir with your husband, Brian. So when he came to Dublin the next time, we met up, and he came out to Baldoyle, where the Forget-Me-Not sings every Tuesday morning, and we had great crack with him. He was just wonderful, and he also then got us involved. He had recorded The Dutchman, and Donal Lunny came out, and we sang the chorus, and they stitched together. I don't know how these things technically happen, but they stitched together Brendan singing it when he was in his 30s and our choir singing the chorus.
Yeah.
And we recorded it, and it was sold very extensively over Christmas last year for Engaging Dementia in the hospitals and in some of the shops.
And of course.
And so he stayed involved, and then this idea of this legacy concert emerged. It's now being produced by Brian Redden of Derek Films. And Brendan was going to do the emceeing, but sadly he passed away in July. Mm. And so, but he left instructions that he wanted the Forget-Me-Nots Choir to sing at it. So we are going to sing at it. And in the meantime, it was quite a small venture, I think, to start with, but after Brendan's death, it began to really grow, and Brian Redden has put together a really stellar cast, as I say.
It's a great
lineup.
Looking
forward to it tomorrow.
Tomorrow night in the Olympia Theatre. And of course, your connection with dementia is a very personal one. You mentioned your husband Brian already. And
yes, that's why we joined the choir. I found this choir, Forget-Me-Nots, which was started by three sisters whose mother had dementia, Orla Horn and her two sisters, Karen and Fiona. And they started it. They were already in a choir, what I call a kind of a real choir that was doing competitions and everything. They started the Forget-Me-Nots, started I think with about 5 or 6 people in the room. Now we're bulging out the community centre, and they keep saying to me, Nora, don't mention it again, more people want to get into it. But there's probably 150 at least members in it now, but not everybody comes every week, they can't manage
and
it.
And not everybody has dementia.
And not at all. But there are people with other kinds of difficulties, frailty, wheelchairs, walking frames and that. And anybody with dementia, Alzheimer's, very welcome. They must have somebody with them. They can't be, it's not a place just to drop somebody.
Yes, yes.
They're there. But what's good about it is, Nora Walsh, our musical director, we sing the old songs. Because when I went with Brian, I thought, oh gosh, he find it hard to learn new songs. But they were all the songs he knew. And the minute we'd start them, he didn't have to read. I had to read the words. He didn't have to read the words. And I see that now with some of the people around me with dementia. They go straight
in. We've heard this. And even you know, Glenn Campbell, that documentary,
that's
don't
right,
you ever
yeah,
saw it,
I did.
That there is something about the brain and singing.
Yes.
And that dementia doesn't seem to have an effect on.
I mean, some of the older memories stay.
Yes.
It's the more current stuff and capability. I often say my little grandson, Alfie, who's 5 now, and Miller, who's 3, like, they're learning every day, whereas Brian was unlearning
yes,
every day. So
yeah,
tying the shoelaces, pulling up the socks, all the things that little children learn. Somebody with dementia is losing that capacity day by day,
which is,
and it's
so
heartbreaking.
Sad, yeah.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
So you're losing this person that you
yes,
that you
yeah,
lived and, with and loved.
And, yeah, and sort of you go to say something and then you realise you're not quite getting it. I mean, the early days in 2007 when we had the first diagnosis or the first inkling, we had an MRI done and it showed up 5 what they call TIAs. Don't ask me to say they're transischemia something or other. And
so
they're like little strokes.
Mini strokes. Yes.
And depending on how strong they are, they, which brain cells they kill. And so if it's the speech or the sound or the hearing, they go. And so you know that what's ahead of you is more cognitive loss and more right, impairment. But it took me 3 years after that to actually bite the bullet and go to the geriatrician yeah, and get the diagnosis, because there's a stigma
I've
attached.
I've spoken to you before,
right?
Yeah. And you were in denial. Was
yeah,
it
I was.
To protect and yourself
it was
or
to protect myself.
Brian?
I was to protect Brian more, because I didn't want people. He looked exactly the same every year and he still nearly looks the same now. He's got a bit older now because he's 86. But I didn't want people kind of pointing or looking and saying, God, do you see any difference and all the rest? And so sometimes if he wasn't quite catching what they were saying, I'd say it a little louder, he's a little bit deaf. You used little euphemisms like that to kind of cover, not your embarrassment, but just people didn't talk about it. And I decided when I went public that really we needed to talk about it. And your programme and other programmes now, every few weeks now, you're getting somebody on who's willing to talk about it. Because I remember reading, I went to the Citizens Assembly, did a thing about ageing. And one of the doctors there, I remember the end of his speech, and I looked it out in the last few days, and he said, there's a discrepancy in the healthcare system between the care for acute illnesses, things like cancer, and those with slow, debilitating illness like dementia. We have lots of money into certain
We front load. Things like cancer.
But dementia and that is still the poor relation. And we have to recognise it's coming down the road.
Exactly. We've been told that we're going to live longer because of medical advances.
Yes, yeah.
So more of us are going to have dementia.
The Alzheimer's Society is brilliant at engaging dementia. But the Alzheimer's Society, you know, is still, they're providing great services, but there are loads of towns and villages where there's no service at all for somebody. Now, we've just started in Malahide. We start a little society and we have now opened a centre for people to attend one day a week. And Lee and the carers don't have to stay with them because it's professionally being run professionally by people who know what
they're
doing.
So it's a respite.
So it's a respite from 12 to 5 on a Monday. But they have to be diagnosed, have to be assessed by the person running it. Maeve has to assess them. We don't have any say, obviously, in who gets
in. But as you say, it's a geographical lottery.
It's a geographical lottery. And sometimes it's geographical based on if the community has the capacity to fundraise. Mm. Like Malahide would have the capacity to fundraise. So I'm on the fundraising committee, we have to raise about 20,000 a year to fund that centre. Mm. And we've had some very generous donations already. Gibney's gave us a very large pub out there, gave us a very large donation. But these are the kind of things that stop people putting in a centre like this. And so, I mean, when the budget comes up now, I always use the opportunity to talk to former colleagues and remind them not to forget, because, you know, there's lots of needs, but this dementia is really growing and people don't realise there's about 400 different types of dementia. And even in the choir now and the people coming in to sing tomorrow, nobody in the audience will know who's standing on the stage who has it. But there are differences. I can see differences. Some of them like to clap and make noise during the singing, and we just let them get on with it. And others are quiet and they just do the singing.
It's a difficult question. It seems to me, in talking to people like yourself, and we had Kathy and Kevin in recently, and both of them are suffering with two different types of dementia, that when it gets to its, you know, its worst stage, that it's probably more difficult for the carers, the people that are left
behind.
Yes,
well, I mean, I often think that the person with the dementia, and that they're not as aware of, you know, their cognitive thing has been disappearing. So as long as, you know, there's somebody caring for them and feeding them and washing them and getting them, you know, ready to go out if you're going out, the carer's life changes. You know, my life has changed with the caring of Brian, but I always say, because people will ring in and say this, I said, we both have pensions, so we have the capacity to get some outside help in. And so in the last 3 or 4 years, I was getting people in from a very good group called Be Independent. And they were coming, if I had a meeting, I would ring them and say, I need you for 3 hours on a Tuesday afternoon or Monday morning, whatever it is. And they would come in, and
you've
Brian got
pensions,
to know them.
Good,
and we've good pensions and we could afford that. But there's lots of people
who can't.
And that's why the need for the government of the day to recognise that this is a silent, sad, lonely kind of existence for a lot of carers. And remember, they're all older. Like, 9 out of 10 people over 65 do not get dementia, but 1 out of 10 does.
Yeah.
And so, and then there's a lot more people getting earlier dementia before the age of 60. And that's so sad because these are people who are still in the prime of their life, as it were, and they have to give up their jobs.
Did Brian know what was coming down the tracks? Did you have...
No, I don't think he did.
I think,
I mean, there were times when I'd say, Brian, you forgot that. Ah, no, sure, you forgot this yesterday. Early on, he was able to say to me, I forgot things as well. So in his mind, it was just being a bit forgetful.
So was the word dementia ever used in front of
him? No, not really. Now, our doctor did kind of quietly say, look, get the MRI done. And when we had it done, he said, you know, you really need to think in terms of what this might be leading to. But people don't use it. They do use it now to me, people who are, but I've met people who I knew, both the husband and wife in a couple or a partner, and I didn't know. They never exchanged that their husband or wife had dementia until I went public and they began to tell me.
And you've never had a heart-to-heart with Brian?
No, not really, no, about it, no.
Why?
We didn't. Like the doctor, when we go to his geriatrician, the geriatrician would talk to him and say, well, Brian, you went to the pictures yesterday, didn't you? And he'd say, yes or no, usually the opposite of what was the truth,
yes,
you know, because he didn't. But his short-term memory was so, so bad. And we didn't talk about it when he was still quite alert. And I'm sorry I didn't now, you know, because there were things I should really have raised with him. Although we started immediately, did things like the enduring power of attorney, which is, you know, the message I try to give out to people. Even anybody over 60 should be doing them anyway, whether they have dementia or not, because it sets down what you want done if something happens to you. So we did that and did things like changing our bank accounts into both our names and our electricity and gas bills, which should always be in both names of the people in the house, because an awful lot of women in Ireland years back didn't put their names, and now they're finding it difficult. They've no, when they're asked for proof of address, they've no address to give them because it's still the man's password.
So
that sort of thing. So we didn't really, Brian and I didn't really talk about the progression. It might be my fault, it might be my fear, it might have been, I thought, I don't want to upset him, because he was still able to do quite a bit up to about 5 years ago. Then reading began to go and concentration on the telly. He painted a lot. He used to do very nice paintings, but, you know, he'd set down to do it, but, you know, an hour later there wouldn't be much done. Concentration goes and language goes. The words disappear. You can't get the words out. That was the bit I noticed most. He'd start to say something and I'd say, what are you trying? And I tried to give him another way of saying it, and then he'd get frustrated a bit and I'd say it and then he'd get it back again. He doesn't have much speech now.
Yes.
And he has certain visual things. He'd point out to the garden in the nursery. He's in a nursing home now, point out, and there'd be nothing there, but a bird might have flown by and he might think they're people or tree or something, you know. So it's sad to watch. At the same time, he's happy. I mean, he's relaxed, and that keeps me happy.
Because you were on the telly with us this time last year, actually.
Yes, yeah.
This time last year, and you didn't say it on air, but we had a long chat, yeah. And you were saying that Brian going into a nursing home was imminent. And
well, I felt it was, because last year in June, our choir was going up to sing in Bloom. They were doing the Reminiscence Garden in Bloom, and they asked the choir up to sing, and I was in the bus with Brian. We were going up there, and I had a bad fall. I sat on that drop-down seat at the front, and it popped up, and I didn't realise, and I went backwards down, cracked my back, and ended up in Connolly Hospital that day. And I suppose it was a wake-up call, because I didn't luckily break a hip. Ray, it's the first time I ever was glad I was well padded. I made a kind of joke out of it. If I'd been skinny, I would have definitely broken my hip. But thank God I'm well padded. And so you can sometimes being a little bit better padded is a help. You'd be so slim, you'd break your hip, you know. And so when I came home, I had to move downstairs. I couldn't climb stairs, and we had to get somebody in to sleep in the house with us for 4 or 5 nights until I was able to move. Because one of the other things with people with dementia, they get up a lot during the night, and you know, 5, 6, 7 times sometimes, and so you'd always
to go to
be on there.
Yeah,
and just they wouldn't really know why they right. got up, and usually would be the bathroom. And so I began to really have to think, and I spoke to my two sons and my son who was living abroad at that stage. And, you know, I said, we think we might be coming towards a stage. And they were very willing to recognise that too, which is a great help. They weren't saying, oh, no, Mum, you have to keep him at home or anything. They recognised that it was becoming harder. And I knew that if I had any health problems, which touch wood I didn't, except for this fall, there would be a problem. So we began to look around then at that stage. He got a bit of respite in Highfield, and then we found a lovely small nursing home out in St. Margaret's called New Park, and they're absolutely wonderful. Yeah. And I can't praise the caring staff enough. We sometimes forget that attached to these nursing homes there's the nurses and the doctors, the professional people, the pharmacists or whatever, but there's also a huge cadre of wonderful carers, you know, who are FITAC 5, FITAC 6 trained. And I often think we don't really pay enough respect to them, that kind of, because if they weren't there, these nursing homes would not be able to operate. Mm. And, you know, we really have to recognise that this is a very respectable, good career to have as a carer, and give that kind of comfort to people like me.
And how was the transition from home to the nursing home?
Oh, well, Brian didn't notice it really. My son and myself took him up. We took him up at lunchtime on purpose so that somebody would take him off for his lunch. We left. I don't want to get upset, but we left. We hung up all his clothes and put them in a drawer and did the usual. And then we left. I didn't say goodbye to him that day because I thought he doesn't really know. And he was sitting having his lunch, and they came back and said, oh, he's enjoying his lunch. And he was always a good man for his food. And then we waited for about 24, 48 hours before we went out to see him. And you know, I think he settled in. Now, you want to think that, you want to feel that. He certainly didn't try to follow us out or say, I want to go home or anything like that. And I haven't taken him back home. That's everybody's choice. Some people maybe think it's a good idea. We've taken him out, but not back to Malahide to his home, because I thought that would confuse him a lot.
And he's there about a year now.
And he's a year. If you'd asked me yesterday, I would have said a few months, but it's actually a year. So the first few months are just heartbreaking. You're caught with, did I make the right decision? Is it the right thing to do? Now, obviously, his doctor and all supported what we were doing, but you feel, look, you can't help but feel you're kind of letting them go because you can't keep them at home any longer. And it's funny, my mother was a widow most of her life. My father died when I was 4, and my mother had 6 children under 10, and she was very independent. And when she got Parkinson's, and without us knowing, she just took herself out and got herself a bed in Our Lady's Manor, where she had been. She used to visit Michael Collins' sister out there for a long time, and she knew it, and they had mass and they did all the things she wanted, and she didn't say anything to us. You know, she didn't want to come and live with one of us, and she went out. And I probably learned from that there's a moment at which you make this kind of decision.
You have to let go.
You have to let go, and you make a decision, and you know, I had sons. I didn't have daughters. I was conscious of wonderful daughters-in-law, but it wasn't my job to hand them my husband to be minded, you know. And I mean, they would mind him in our house, but it's a very big decision, and it's a financially very heavy decision on people. And you know, each month as it goes by, it gets a little bit easier. But there are times when I want to do something, or something's about to happen, and I go to nearly tell Brian about it, and he's not there, you know.
And when you go in, does he recognise you?
Oh, he does. He does. Yeah. He's a great walker. I mean, one of the things that dementia brings on is something called pacing, and a lot of people with dementia walk round and round and round, you know, and that's why a lot of them people do get lost, because they go out and then they just keep walking.
Okay. And there's an urge to walk.
There's an urge to walk and just keep going, whether it's to find somewhere. I mean, one taxi man told me that they found his father. He's trying to get back to his old house where he'd grown up, and eventually they found him. Yeah. And it's very, very frightening for somebody to get lost. Very frightening for the carers and the people looking for them, because you just don't know what will have happened. And we've heard of tragedies.
Yeah, well, it happened to a man in Spain recently, didn't it?
That's right, yes. And I knew he was in a big shopping centre, and his wife obviously turned to look at something, and then he's gone. Yeah. And it happened to me one day in the pavilions in Swords. I had the grandchildren, and suddenly I was minding them, and suddenly I didn't see Brian. So Milo, who's now 10, but he was only about 8 or maybe even 7, he did a dash around and found him, brought him back by the hand, you know. And Brian was luckily just at the door of the shop. He hadn't gone out. But if he'd gone out into the main part of it, you know, it's a kind of a worry, and people, I'm sure, have to face that. So you do keep a hold of people.
Is it because people describe, you know, grieving, yes, even when the person is still alive?
Ah, yes.
When it comes to dementia,
Is
Brian a different person?
Well, yeah, because he's not communicating anything.
Right.
To us, you know, other than enjoying a cup of tea, and he loves his biscuits, and he'll enjoy that. But there's no verbal communication, really. And, you know, like, I go in and I tell him things, but I don't know how much of it he's taken in. You know, we've brought in, you know, one of the things you do, you have a photo album in the room, and you go through them. And some of them he kind of will point to and will remember that, yeah, that's so-and-so. And, well, he mightn't know the name, but he'd say, oh, yeah, or something, when I say, now, that's Paddy that you knew in Yall. He was from Yall. And, you know, he might sort of cop that, but the current ones. And then there's other moments, like, Brian hasn't driven for several years, because I just felt once he had the dementia, I really didn't want to have him getting lost or causing an accident. And I do worry sometimes people aren't thinking that they should stop the driving, but that's up to them. But we've taken him out now during the summer on the fine days, and there's a lovely place near the donkey shed on the road to Ashburn and we take him out. But the minute he gets into the car and has the seatbelt on, he turns and he says, clear left, because that was his job, to tell me there was nothing coming from the left. And
he
does it, and I nearly cried when I heard it the first time, and it was absolutely the clearest words I'd heard, clear left. And then I said thank you, and we carried on.
It's nearly like a reflex now.
It was a reflex, absolutely reflex. And but he knew why he was looking, to make sure there was no car coming, and he said clear left. And it's just one of those things that kind of gives you a little start for a minute, and you just hope that he is. I mean, they'll tell me there if there's anything wrong.
Anne-Marie O'Farrell says, thanks for giving you... Oh, yeah, yeah. Much appreciated letting Nora talk about dementia on air. Nora is right. You're on your own with not much help. It's like prison without inmates. It kills care and the person they look after. And how are you getting on at home alone? Somebody wants to know. Yeah. That's Anna.
Yeah. Well, that's fine. In fact, my son is back living with me.
Is he? Right, okay. So you're completely fine.
And so it's not too bad. I mean, one of the other things, I mean, Anne-Marie, there, you don't have to be alone. People will offer help. But here's the thing. At a certain stage, somebody's saying, I'll come in and you go out. Sometimes the preparation for that
can put you off a bit.
And that's why I was using the professional carers, because they would come in and literally I would say, I'm off. And they knew what to do. I mean, I had done things like, you know, the things they advise you on the website. You know, I'd marked the presses in the kitchen saying plates and cups and biscuits and cake, and I had put another banisters in the up the stairs, and you know, I had done things like that to help with preparations. But
can you, Nora, as a former politician, you know, impress upon your colleagues?
Yeah.
Like, we had Brendan Courtney in last week, and I don't know, we have to talk about Dad. So he was pressing for expanding the Fair Deal scheme into nursing homes.
Yes, they're talking about that, but everything seems to take so long to do. And I also think there's probably a gap in the HSE and the Department of Health, that there's a home care, you can get home care an hour a day or something, and even without a medical card, you're eligible for that. But I do worry that I don't know how much training on the I mean, people are very good. They come in and they make breakfast or get somebody up and dressed or bandaged. But I don't know how much emphasis are being put on people who can cope with dementia because people can get quite aggressive. They won't want to do what you ask them to do. If you say, you know, put your clothes on, they might resist it. They might. I mean, Brian was fairly gentle, but once or twice I had to put him into bed in his clothes because he just wouldn't take his clothes off and the shoes and everything. So you waited until he fell asleep and then took the shoes off, left him in the trousers and shirt, and the next morning changed them, you know. And you just make little allowances like that.
Yeah. Tomorrow night, the Olympia Theatre, it doesn't say if there's tickets.
Well, I think there might be a very few tickets left. Right, so if somebody really would like to come and hear all these wonderful artists, including the Forget-Me-Nots Choir, and Ronan Collins is going to do the emceeing, so that's brilliant. And if there may be some tickets left, a small number. Brian Redden said there could be a small number left. So
and there, tomorrow night at half floating 7. Over the whole proceedings will be the spirit of Brendan Grace.
Absolutely. And there'll be lots of, there's a few comedians. I think Mario Rosenstock is coming, and Twink will probably, she was a great friend of. Yeah. So there are people who are probably going to have a little reminder of Brendan's jokes. I mean, he was great for the stories.
Nora, great to see you.
Thank you very much,
Ryan. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And good luck tomorrow night with the choir.
Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
And we're joined in the studio by Conor Pope, Pricewatch at RTE.ie. Now, what we're going to do, Conor, is I'm going to read out our problem today that came into Pricewatch. You're going to give us a brief bit of it, then I'm going to take another commercial break, and then you can finish it off.
Okay.
I'm saying that for myself, and saying it for
good.
You,
it's
and for our listeners.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is obviously, we only got it in today because it's to do with Thomas Cook. Conor, Pricewatch, Ray, I have two trips to Anfield to see Liverpool play, and we booked with Thomas Cook Sports. This was the only way we could get tickets. The tickets are for a home game against Spurs at the end of October and a home game against Napoli in November. The tickets are for me, my wife and children, and we paid more than £1,500 sterling for them. We bought the flight separately. Where do we stand today?
Now, this is actually quite interesting because there's been an awful lot of talk about Thomas Cook over the last 12 or 14 hours since it emerged that the company was going into liquidation and it was ceasing to exist. And that has stranded tens of thousands of people at holiday destinations all over Europe. It has seen tens of thousands of people having their holidays cancelled. But this is a very specific problem, and it's a problem that I suspect will impact quite a few people in the Republic of Ireland who maybe have gone under the radar in recent hours, because the focus in the early days of a story like this tends to be on what's going to happen to the people who are
repatriate the people.
You know, there was talk about the biggest repatriation effort in peacetime in England, and it all sounds very dramatic, and in fact it has been very dramatic over the last 12 hours, because the company is, I think, if it's not the oldest, it's certainly amongst the oldest tour operators in the world, and it was one of the very, very first companies to start bringing people on package holidays anywhere, because you must remember the tour operating business is effectively less than 50 or 60 years old, but that company, Thomas Cook, was 178 years old, so it's a big deal.
Now
I know we can't actually go into the specifics of the problem
there's
yet.
The context. I'm going to take a commercial break and we'll get your answer after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551 Ray at RTE.ie. Now, Conor Pope is with us. Thomas Cook. This family have booked two weekends to see their favourite team, Liverpool, playing. One at the end of October against Spurs, and then in November against Napoli.
And they've spent quite... they've 1,500 euros. Now, yeah, that's 15, not just for the tickets, to be clear, and it's not... it's for a family of two adults and I think two kids or three kids, and it also covers hotel rooms.
As a two weekends?
It's two different weekends, and I think one of them is a midweek. So it's like... okay. So it's not that the tickets cost that much money. Now, the travel operator... this is actually a big business for was a big part of the Thomas Cook business, and it's been advertising trips to the Italian Grand Prix, to the Barcelona, the camp, the new camp, and to the England cricket tour of South Africa. It also sells packages to Chelsea, Tottenham Hotspur, Manchester City and Manchester United.
So that's a lot of Irish people
would be booking. Particularly, I would imagine that the two or three big clubs for Irish people would be Liverpool, Manchester United and Arsenal. So that's... and that would be a part of the business. Now, both... I've just picked two of those clubs. Both Liverpool and Manchester United have been all over this, as you can imagine, in the last 6 or 7 hours, because these are... this... it's big business. They're very used to dealing with fans, and they're not like a lot of enterprises, which sometimes dealing with people is a chore for them. So, for instance, Manchester United have confirmed that Thomas Cook had been its chosen travel partner and said that they had pre-sold a small number of tickets and hospitality for some matches this season, along with travel packages to some of their away European games. And what they're saying is that as soon as they became aware of the insolvency... now, this is Manchester United, so it's not really our listeners' problem. I'll come to that in a second. As soon as Manchester United became aware of the potential insolvency, it had started to work through contingency plans, and they'll endeavour to contact affected Manchester United fans who had booked direct. So they're going to take control of the issue themselves. And for its part, Liverpool have issued a statement, and they said that they are also aware that Thomas Cook has ceased trading, and it said it sells around 360 packages for each of its home games. So that's 360 people who are in the same position as our listener. It says that it's currently assessing the impact that Thomas Cook going out of business is going to have, and once it has got its head around exactly what it means for its business, it's going to be contacting those customers directly. So, I can't speak for these big clubs, but when you think you're talking about a relatively small number of tickets, and it may be that what the clubs do is they step in and say, okay, we're going to honour these tickets, even though we haven't got the money from Thomas Cook. But that still leaves two different... and they may not do that, but you know, if they have any sense, that's what they would do.
Legally,
they wouldn't be under any obligation to do that. Because
but legally, what's going to happen? What happens when a company goes bust?
Well, this is the thing. Now, there are avenues that our listener can travel down to try and get some kind of recompense. I mean, when a company goes bust, when it ceases trading, that's it. The holiday is effectively gone. Now, if you've booked a package holiday, you're covered by the UK's bonding system, which operates much the same way as the Irish travel agents' bonding system, and it's called ATOL. And if it was a package holiday that had the flights, accommodation and all the rest included, you'd get all your money back. And that's the end of the story. It's all done and dusted. But with this kind of scenario, which they've booked their flights independently, they have their accommodation as part of the package, and they have their tickets as part of the package, they could argue that it is a package holiday, and as a result, they would be entitled to a full refund. But that they would have to argue that case. Now, in this case, imagine a scenario whereby Liverpool give them the tickets, they still wouldn't have their accommodation sorted. So what they would have to do, and this is where it gets somewhat complex, because we've talked about the whole chargeback process before. When you go to your credit card company and you say, I've paid for this with my credit card, I haven't got the service as promised, and then a process starts, a machine starts rolling, and ultimately you'd get your money back. It's going to be more complicated for people if they have their flight sorted. That's one element, completely irrelevant to this story. If they get their tickets but they don't get their accommodation, they would have to try and get the money back for their accommodation. So it would be more complicated. But at this stage, we don't know what's going to happen, because it's really, right now, for want of a better phrase, the ball is in the courts of all the big football clubs. But it is going to impact hundreds of potentially Irish people.
Hopefully it works out. Just, we were talking about plastic bags, and I was presented with a compostable plastic bag option yesterday for 89 cent. One of our listeners says, I think those compostable bags, while good for the environment, are a rip-off. There has to be a huge profit margin. I buy compostable bags from my food bin, and depending on the brand, they're only a few cent each. Why not buy a pack of them on your emergency shop and keep the rest of them for lining your bin? Well, Nora Owen pointed out that the compostable bags that you buy for 89 cent are stronger than those. You wouldn't be able to bring your shopping home in that. Try shopping in my local supermarket. They use the old style flimsy plastic bags and don't charge. Neither do any Chinese takeaways in this area, says Jerry. And our refuse collector specifically requests us not to use those compostable bags as they clog up their machinery, says Jerry in Tralee. Where's the 22-cent bag gone?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the 22-cent bag was one of those rare moments when Irish people were delighted to pay a tax, because the tax was ring-fenced for so-called environmental issues. And what it saw was a dramatic decline in the use of plastic bags amongst Irish people, because we just hated the notion of giving people money unnecessarily. So the 22-cent plastic bag tax was a brilliant initiative that was rolled out more than 15 years ago. It started to lose its way a little bit in 2008, I think, when Dunn Stores got into a dispute with the tax man over the plastic bags and how it was collecting the money. So it just said, right, fact that, we're not going to have any plastic bags anymore, we're only going to have these bigger bags. And they price those bigger bags at something like 79 cent for the bigger, stronger bags. And they dress them up as bags for life. Now, the reality is, I, and I suspect many of your listeners, have a billion bags for life in our houses because we never have them when we need them. So then Super Value followed suit and got rid of its 22 cent plastic bags, and it started selling these so-called bags for life at, again, 79 cent. Recently, Marks & Spencer got rid of its plastic bags and it only has the bigger bags, and again, they cost 79 cent. Now, the 79 cent is important here, because if a retailer sells a bag for less than 70 cent, it becomes liable to pay the 22 cent tax.
Right.
If it sells a bag for more than 78 cent, for more than 70 cent, it's not liable to pay it. So all the money that it gets for a 79 cent bag goes to the retailer. If it was to sell a bag for 70 cent, it would have to give 22 cent of that to the taxman.
Which is ring-fenced for environmental
issues. Environmental issues. So this notion, and I don't mean to be hard on Super Value, but the idea that they would price the compostable bag at 89 cent is ludicrous. The bags don't cost 8 cent to make. Yeah. So they are making a huge... And I'm not saying they're not making a huge profit. Let's face it. They're not going to have an IPO based on this. But they're making money by exploiting people's desire to be more environmentally conscious. And I think if a good retailer would say, we'll give you the compostable bags for 19 cent, or we'll give it to you for cost.
Yes.
And that way they would be helping the environment. They wouldn't be profiting from this desire to help with the environment, and we'd all be winners. But instead, what you're seeing is 89 cent, which I think is too dear. But I can imagine that they won't be listening to me, and I can imagine all the other retailers will be listening
Follow
to them,
suit.
And they'll think, "Oh, that's a bit that's handy." Now, again, I don't know how much their compostable bags cost, but as you say, if you can
they don't
buy
have to tell us either, do they?
Not at all. But if you can buy a roll of compostable bags, albeit of slightly less solid structure, if you can buy them for like a euro, I'm sure they're getting them at a pretty good deal, and I'm sure they're not costing anything close to the 89 cent of the charge
in you. No, they're not. Okay, Conor, thanks very much. Pricewatch at rte.ie if you want Conor to grapple with any of your consumer issues. We'll talk to you next Monday. Thanks, Conor Pope.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Yeah, 51551 for your text, or ray@rte.ie. Now, last week, you may not have spotted this, was World Childless Week. And writer, columnist and broadcaster Christina Patterson shared how being single and childless made her feel a sense of shame over failing to follow the traditional path set out by society. She's on the line now. Good afternoon, Christina.
Hello.
So you've written in your book, The Art of Not Falling Apart, and you wrote an article last week, which was featured in a lot of newspapers, about being childless. It's a terrible term, isn't it?
It is. Some people try to use the term child-free, but to me that sounds a little bit contrived, I must say. But childless definitely makes it sound as though there's something lacking. And people never talk about men being childless. It's always women who are childless. And the implication is that you've somehow failed as a woman. You haven't done the thing you were put on this planet to do. You are some kind of biological failure and possibly even a freak. So it definitely sounds like you're, you know, it makes you feel like a kind of Anita Bruckner heroine, some dried up spinster who should be cowering in a corner in dowdy clothing instead of living a rich, full, interesting life.
And then there's the involuntary childlessness and voluntary childlessness.
Yes.
Yeah, terrible terms. Let's find out a little bit about you first. So I suppose I have to ask you your age for the purposes of this particular interview.
I'm 55.
Right, okay. And would you put yourself in the voluntary or involuntary category?
Oh, involuntary, definitely. My parents had children when they were very young. They got married when they were very young. My mother was 18, my father was 21. They were walking up a hill in Heidelberg, fell in love at first sight. My father sent my mother a telegram a few weeks later saying, "Will you marry me?" She sent one back saying, "Yes." It was all incredibly romantic. And I grew up thinking that, you know, something similar would happen to me. Mm. And I sort of got through my 20s without meeting the love of my life. And as the months and years started ticking down, it felt like this, you know, with a kind of bomb about to go off. I think it does for a lot of women, because the body clock is a reality. And really, you are better off having children really by your sort of early 30s at the latest. Plenty of women are having children older now. But after that, if you wait longer than that, it is a risk. And I just didn't meet the right bloke at the right time. And I didn't feel it was something I wanted to do, going ahead and having children without a father for them. And by the age, by the time I reached 39, I found a lump in my breast and was diagnosed with breast cancer. So by then it was certainly beginning to feel too late. So I did not choose not to have children. And in fact, in response to that article I wrote last week, it was posted with a headline that possibly was slightly misleading, but I got an awful lot of comments from people saying, "You're going to be lonely in your old age." And you kind of think, well, you know, thanks a lot.
The heading was, "Life without children can be rewarding."
Yes, well, I don't know. I suppose that some people, it's very strange how emotional people get about this. Even people, one presumes, that are in happy relationships with children, who then feel that I must be some kind of ball-breaking feminist, you know, with sort of completely kind of poleaxed by ambition, who somehow wants to deprive the rest of the world of children. I didn't choose not to have children. As I said in the article, it was circumstantial. However, there are all kinds of things in life that we can't control and don't choose. And it doesn't mean that we can't have a rich, full, interesting life in all kinds of different circumstances.
But that's not always how you felt. You know,
absolutely not. No,
you were heartbroken. That's what I get from the article.
Yes, I wasn't heartbroken all the time.
No.
There were moments when it felt very hard, and some of the time it felt okay. There was, I talk in the article about one incident when I went into a local cafe and I'd ordered coffee and a croissant and thought I'd bought myself, you know, about an hour of newspaper reading time. And as soon as I took the last bite of the croissant, the waiter kind of practically threw me out. And there was a sort of women hovering with their buggies and their babies, clearly desperate to take the seats over. And he thought, well, I think I'll have two mums here. That will be a better use of the space and time. And of course, you know, it may not have been personal, but I went feeling like a lesser person and a lesser woman. And in the area that I live in, at one point, apparently it had the highest birth rate in Europe, which when you're not able to have children doesn't feel entirely helpful when you're practically mown off the pavement by sort of onslaughts of buggies. So there were times when I felt very left out, and I often felt that weekends were family time. So I'd have a packed diary during the week. I always had lots of friends and a very busy social life, and I'd be out every night, and then suddenly the weekend would arrive and that would be the time that friends would spend with their children, completely understandably. Mm. But again, when it comes to weekends and Christmas and bank holidays, you can feel a bit as if, you know, the kind of society has left you behind.
And Christina, how did you feel? Because, you know, people don't mean any harm, or they don't want to offend you or upset you in any way, but they would ask in casual conversation, "Do you have any children yourself?"
Yes, I did. I did often find that painful. And
is that a question that people shouldn't ask anymore, do you think?
Well, there are plenty of things that are more offensive than that in life. Frankly, if you're on social media and you ever go on the telly or radio, you'll be used to seeing an awful lot worse than that. Yeah. So I'm not going to go around telling people to wrap me in cotton wool in case my feelings get hurt, because, you know, frankly, I'm not a kind of, you know, 12-year-old who needs wrapping in cotton wool.
Yeah.
But I think that, generally speaking, I think probably if a woman doesn't have children, it's not a bad idea to approach the subject with a reasonable amount of delicacy, because, or a man for that matter, there are plenty of men who would like to have children who, for all kinds of reasons, haven't managed it. And I think you never, ever know whether it's a choice or it isn't a choice. And I think, you know, some people just talk endlessly about their children without giving much consideration to the other person and what their situation might be. So I think it's really just about good manners, actually.
And of course, with advances in modern medicine and fertility treatment, it is possible for a woman to have a baby without a man.
Yes, and some of my friends sort of thought in as they were approaching 40 about going ahead and doing that. And in fact, I mean, they were actually investigating sperm banks, and they then met men, actually in a couple of cases, not very nice men, and the relationships didn't work out. They did get the children, and they are lovely children, and they're very happy with those children. And but without wanting to obviously kind of identify anyone, I do think that it's not an ideal situation when your relationship with your ex-partner isn't great. You don't particularly like and respect the father of your child, and you are in a kind of semi-permanent relationship of some kind with them, because your child is going to spend at least probably every other weekend with them and shape them and have a strong influence on them. But not very much in life is perfect. And if people make the decision to go ahead and have children on their own or end up being a single parent, I think that's absolutely up to them. And I think you can be a wonderful parent as a single parent, and you can be a wonderful parent as a joint parent, and you can be a terrible parent as a single parent and as a joint parent. Yes, really, it's all about the parenting. It's not about your situation.
I suppose human beings are very adaptable. You know, so whatever life presents us with, we can adapt to it. And we, in a way, we have, not only do we have to do it physically, but we have to mentally rationalise our situation, don't we?
Exactly. I think that's absolutely right. But I think actually it's one of the many good things about getting older is that you learn to adapt more. You realise that you might have this very idealistic view of what a life should be when you're younger, and you think, you know, there are all these boxes that should be ticked, and then you realise that life sort of will probably conspire against you to make sure that quite a lot of those boxes aren't ticked, and some of those boxes will be wrenched out of your hands, and you'll be, you know, wrestling with them. But I think we do all have a choice, and unless you actually suffer from clinical depression, which is a whole other thing, but where we do all have a choice actually is really how far to be grateful for the life we have, how to relish the things we have, how to find joy in our daily lives. I think that is both a gift and a choice. And I've always found a huge amount of joy in my daily life, but I probably find more now at 55 than I did at 35 when I was worrying about whether I would ever have children.
And do you think you spent too much time, you know, worrying about that path you thought you had to follow? Find a man, settle down, have a family.
I do, actually. I do. I mean, I didn't literally sit down and worry about it without doing other things. I always had a very kind of very active life and a very energetic work life. And, you know, I sort of did masses of things. But I do. I think regret. Well, look, if you feel sad, you feel sad. But I wish someone could tell you that, you know what, you can live life in all kinds of different ways, and many of those ways will actually be wonderful, and there will be joy, and there will be pain, and there will be peaks, and there will be troughs. But all in all, if you go into it with the right spirit, and you know how to make good friends, and you know how to foster profound, meaningful relationships, you will have a rich, interesting life.
Speaking of relationships, you're in a relationship for the last 4 years, and your partner has grown up children.
Yes.
So you've obviously had the chats with him about having children and not having children.
We don't talk about it all that much because once you know as a woman that you can't have children, I'm someone who tends not to dwell in the past, and it's kind of over then. I don't feel it's an academic subject now. I've no idea. I might have had monsters. So, you know, there's no point in thinking I could have had this amazing time. I think, you know, he, of course, he loves his children. They're very nice boys. They're now grown up. They're nice young men. I have, you know, a good relationship with them. I think that, you know, that's all been fine. But, you know, in lots of ways, I've had a very interesting time. I've travelled to all kinds of places he hasn't. I've had all kinds of career highs and lows that he hasn't. I think we've just had very different lives, and I don't think his has been better than mine.
I suppose we like to think we have control over our lives, and forget about the children and all. One of the things I suppose that you hadn't got, or you had a perception of not having, was control, because you wanted to have children and the world, whatever, conspired against you.
Well, you know what? I think toddlers think they can control the world, and so does Donald Trump. But I think that most people discover fairly swiftly that there's a fair amount in their lives they can't control. Yeah. And if you don't discover that when you're 25, you'll certainly discover it at 35. So I think that's just called being a grown-up.
And what, life without children can be rewarding. So you've made sense of it all now, obviously. And do you still look at your friends with children and wonder what it would be like if you had your own?
I don't really. I mean, my friends have lovely children, and again, some of them are grown up, some of them are younger. I don't really think that. I wouldn't be being honest if I didn't say that I'm getting caught up in my negatives now, but I do sometimes have a pang when I see my friends with their children. Of course I do, but it's manageable now. It's not, like a stab to the heart. And I'm also aware that children are not, just kind of delivered to this planet to distribute, to kind of provide unmitigated joy. I see that there is a huge amount of anxiety and pain that goes with that as well. Some friends have children with anxiety in various forms or eating disorders. Life is not straightforward, and I think that I've been spared the fear of what will happen to a child and the huge anxiety you can experience when your child is ill or very, very unhappy. So I think it's a mixed bag, really.
Mixed bag, yes. I see here 1 in 5 Irish women over 45 don't have children, and that percentage is going to rise over the coming years. Christina Patterson, thanks for talking to us today. Enjoy that. Thank you very much. That's it from us. Mary Wilson is on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Monday.